From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today we talk about being targeted, but not necessarily for something bad.
When it comes to the U.S. today, it's really hard to say what is mainstream.
From targeted advertising to minorities, to now targeting something called the total market. And we meet a man trying to bring Latinos to the great outdoors.
We have this connection with nature, and it's lost in just like the daily life, just like work, school, and sometimes you just need to take a step back and go back to nature.
Plus, a new poll aims to understand Latinos and a story about the side effects of fracking. All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we're targeted. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vaya. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Last year, Nielsen, you know, the TV ratings people, announced something they called the power shift, something they say is evolving as we speak. Nielsen said that, quote, the rise of Latinas is driven both by strong demographics and by a healthy inclination towards success in mainstream America. So we're going to break this down a little bit. The Latino population is growing at an escalating pace, and 86% of Latinas say that in their households, it's women who are the ones that have the purchasing power and the decision-making. So this makes Latinas an attractive target to advertisers. But what about this whole success in mainstream America thing? What does that mean for Latinas? And does all of this mean that Latinas are now mainstream? When I was growing up in Chicago, there were almost no Latinos in commercials, let alone Latinas. So to get a sense of how advertising to Latinas has changed now, I sat down with our newest producer, Antonia Cerejido, who happens to be a recent college graduate.
Did you really feel like ads weren't aimed at you when you were growing up?
Were not aimed at me?
Yeah.
Oh, they were definitely not aimed at me. I mean, I was an American kid, right? I mean, I was born in Mexico, but I was being raised in Chicago. So they were aimed at me in as much as they were aimed at any other kid. And if we did appear, you know, it was usually around some kind of stereotype.
Like what?
Well, like, you know, look, I really loved my Frito Bandito eraser.
Let's sing together. You just follow the bouncing Fritos corn chips bag. Ay, 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 ay.
Their mascot, you know, their little character was Frito Bandito, who was a Mexican, a really disheveled, you know, bellied Mexican, you know, revolutionary from Pancho Villa, like kind of typical. I think like even his shirt was a little bit open at the belly button or something. But for me, it was like, my God, they know Mexicans, you know. I was so happy that they, so I got my little eraser and I carried it around in my, you know, my third grade book bag. And then all of a sudden, there was a boycott.
So you felt like you lost a friend or you were betrayed by a friend?
I was very confused about it all. I did. I was like, I don't understand. Like, I'm really happy that they're putting Mexico out there, but I totally get, like, this is a bad image. So, Antonia, you're obviously of a much younger generation than mine. Do you feel like you have been advertised to specifically?
Yeah, well, I remember my freshman year, I was in our cafeteria and I was looking at my friend and I go, you know, Spanish is really taking over. All of the ads on YouTube are in Spanish. And she looks at me and she goes, no, 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 your ads are in Spanish. And it was like a real moment where I was like, oh, my God, they know so much about me. I mean, that's also online advertising. But beyond that, on TV, every tampon commercial, every yogurt commercial features a racially ambiguous woman and who could be my cousin, too. So I do feel like the ads reflect an image that I am familiar with.
What Antonia is describing could be the result of what's known as the new total market approach. Before, advertisers used to think there were two separate markets, the general market and the multicultural market. But now advertisers are seeing people like Antonia as one and the same, both mainstream and multicultural.
When it comes to the U.S. today, it's really hard to say what is mainstream.
That's Christian Fili. He's the Senior VP of Strategic Planning at LatinWorks Marketing, which is an ad agency based out of Austin.
The other conversation that drives me nuts is, can you explain the difference between a multicultural millennial and a non-multicultural millennial? It's a crazy conversation. Because if you continue to think of there are white millennials and there are black millennials and there are brown millennials, you're never really gonna evolve together with how the population is evolving.
The total market approach is about inclusion.
And we look at what we call a total market strategy, which means active inclusion of multicultural consumers. We make sure that multicultural consumers are included throughout, from the way we design research to how we're casting our spots. And that really just becomes part of marketing in a multicultural world.
That's Lizette Williams. She leads multicultural marketing strategy at Kimberly Clark. They make things that you might have heard of, like Huggies. I met Lisette at LatinWorks, where she was hearing some pitches from the LatinWorks pitch team. And to be honest, I'd never been in an office space quite like this one.
Are they playing ping pong?
Mm-hmm. I joined them in their war room to hear their pitch for the Kimberly Clark Celebrate Family Unity campaign.
Of course, as you know, we'll be producing these in both languages. Hello. Hey, sweetie, did you get out of work? Yeah, I'm on my way. Can you pick up some Huggies diapers? Sure, how many? Just bring a box. And then bring me a box, bring me a box, 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 bring me a box. On your way to house, bring me a box. Bring me, bit. And then the guy actually comes in Spanish still. Me voy pa mi casa con mi caja, interjecting to the song, right? So you get that nice texture to it. It's still some authentic reggaeton there.
It's spot on with the target, the modern bicultural Latina. This is something that she would really enjoy.
So just give me a sense of what it is to be a director of multicultural marketing at a major corporation like Kimberly Clark.
10 years ago, someone in my role would likely have been doing very siloed marketing, something that was language-based, likely in the Spanish language for a very targeted, very small group. What's happened over the last 10 years is that we've really seen a shift in the demographics of the United States, particularly with Latinos. Latinos today are growing at a rate of 167%, and that's four times the national average. When you think about that, the face of the U.S. has changed.
Sergio Alcocer is the president and chief creative officer of LatinWorks. He says their company has had many successful spots, as he calls his ads.
These ones here are the equivalent of the Oscar.
Sergio is talking about the Cannes Lion Awards displayed at LatinWorks. They won one Cannes Lion for their funny Starburst llama campaign.
Which one do you want to see first? You want to see the one of the llama, of the llama? Yeah.
In this kind of absurd ad, a long-faced man who looks surprisingly like a llama and a llama take turns feeding each other Starbursts. But a complaint against the total market approach is that it can't be effective if it tries to reach too many people. Hernan Tagliani is a contributing writer to the Orlando Business Journal. He said, quote, "It's basically like serving a burger with every Anglo topping imaginable and then adding beans, rice, sofrito, mofongo, and habanero pepper." But for Sergio Alcocer, it's not about appealing to everyone. It's about delivering a universal message.
Oh, my
Starburst
God.
Between a llama and her
now, that kid, is uh-huh. that a Latino kid?
Yes, but it doesn't matter. The important thing is that we were talking to teens. And a teen is a teen first and a Latino teen second.
And now for a story that you might have missed. And frankly, we want to know why. At least 43 students targeted by Mexican drug organizations and their own government in the Mexican state of Guerrero were kidnapped, and their kidnapping and death has caused a furor throughout Mexico. The doors of Mexico's national palace, El Palacio Nacional, were set on fire by protesters demanding reform, along with the resignation of Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto. Here in the American press, though, there's been barely a peep about this story. Our senior producer, AC Valdez, is here with me to talk about this. AC, you posted about this on Latino USA's Facebook page asking this simple question. Has there been enough coverage about this situation, the victims, the resulting unrest? And the overwhelming response was?
The overwhelming response was no, Maria. The first million comments we got on that Facebook post were nope, not yet, nothing. Everybody who's been following us on Facebook has said the U.S. press hasn't been doing their job on this story, which is astounding given the coverage of ISIS, given the coverage of Ebola. We're not seeing anything about the country right next door, which is going through a huge upheaval. But this has been one of the biggest social media moments for Latino USA this year.
I've mostly been following this through Mexican press, principally La Jornada. I mean, it feels like there is a new alert about every half an hour. Most of the time, that alert is around the name of the town where the students who are now presumed dead were from. It's an interesting pronunciation. I'm not going to try it, but UAC know it. What is the name of the town?
Now, the name of the town is Ayotzinapa, and these students were students at a teacher's college. They were out gathering funds for their basic needs, food, clothing, that kind of thing. It involves stopping traffic and getting involuntary donations from people on the road. They had procured the buses in order to stop that traffic from a town called Iguala. When the mayor of Iguala heard what was going on, he asked that something be done about that because he was concerned that the students were going to interrupt a meeting that his wife was holding. Now, the mayor and his wife both hold very close positions with the local cartel, Guerreros Unidos. And I think one really revealing aspect of the story has been the fact that it's kind of shown in very stark terms what it means to govern locally in Mexico. It means this heavy involvement with cartels.
So as a result, there has been extraordinary response in Mexico saying, where are the students of Ayotzinapa? And then the story began to manifest itself online in an interesting way. A hashtag,
Ya me cansé. And ya me cansé comes from a press conference in which Mexico's attorney general, after an hour of questioning, said those words, I've had enough, I'm tired, I'm giving up.
And that's the attorney general who's saying
and
that.
And it's the attorney general who's saying that. And the protesters turned that around really quickly. And all of a sudden, it's this blow up hashtag on Twitter.
So the students from Ayotzinapa, these words, this hashtag, ya me cansé, basically part of a major story that could have a huge impact on the state of the Mexican government and the state of, frankly, a growing protest movement in Mexico that is tired of the violence and the drug violence.
This story is so fast moving that as a weekly show, I don't think we can always do it justice in terms of how quickly it's moving. So I would encourage anybody listening to us to check our Facebook page, facebook.com/LatinoUSA, and follow the hashtag on Twitter, #YaMeCansé.
Thanks, AC, for being up on this story.
Thank you, Maria.
Coming up on Latino USA.
When you look at our industries here, you know, you have petroleum production, but you also have agriculture. You can't plow a field without diesel. You can't bring product to market without a truck.
Fracking and farming in California. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Está muy raro, no hay...
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. On the internet, the question of how much to assimilate into the mainstream versus how much to carve out a space for yourself is a vibrant one. Some online media outlets make spaces for certain groups like Latinos. So, for example, there's Fox News Latino, and the Huffington Post has pages for Latino voices, Black voices, gay voices. And then there are places like BuzzFeed, which don't break their media down in those ways. Instead, they aim to incorporate those voices directly into their mainstream content. To talk about BuzzFeed's Latino strategy, I'm joined in the studio now by Adrián Carrasquillo. He's the editor of Latino coverage at BuzzFeed. Adrián, welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you for having me.
You've been at BuzzFeed for how long now?
Over a year. I started last June.
So in the year that you've been there, where have you seen the thought in terms of BuzzFeed vis-a-vis Latino issues?
Mm-hmm. Last year, I was the second person with an interest in Latino stuff. Not the second Latino. There were other people doing other stuff. But the second person was like, this is a real opportunity for us. And now we have like a dozen.
You also had the experience of working at NBC Latino, mm-hmm. which was in a lot of ways kind of different, right? It wasn't about just having journalists who happen to be Latino around. It was a site that was dedicated to Latinos.
Yeah.
That site is gone now. So you're kind of like experiencing this now in both different ways.
Yeah.
So the upshot is what? You know, a site that is focused on Latinos, mm-hmm. or having Latinos that are everywhere doing everything,
yeah.
and that it's incorporated into what BuzzFeed does all mm-hmm. the time?
I mean, it's a great question. You know, I think what I'm excited about, the evolution for us, what we're doing, is a huge mainstream place. And we're not creating like a separate place to go find the stuff. We're saying the way that people interact with content, they consume it through social media. You know, they find it on Twitter, on Facebook. I always say I wake up in the morning and I don't say like, I got to go see what my Latinos are doing and I'm going to go to a Latino section of a site. I want to know I'm a New Yorker, I'm a Yankee fan, I'm a bunch of different things. But when I see those stories that matter to me, I will click them and I will say, this is amazing. Oh, look at this. You know, you see the Latino name in the headline.
Today I went to the site and there wasn't anything on the homepage that was Latino specific. Mm-hmm. So are you just saying, yeah, sometimes it's going to be there, sometimes it's not. And that's just the way it is.
Yeah. One part that I think is interesting about what we're doing that's really fun to me is you'll see in our signatures it says BuzzFeed, the news and entertainment company. We're never going to get away, and we don't shy away from the fun stuff we do and from the stuff that gets everybody coming and gets millions of views. And there's a part of that, right, where it's your identity. So whether you're a 90s kid or whether you grew up in Miami, there's ways that things can be Latino or not with just saying Latino, right? We'll do posts on ways you know you grew up with a Latino parent. And we die laughing about those stories. Because we brainstorm about them and we're all like, oh my God, I agree. But that's something that's not happening anywhere else. The fact that there's like 12 Latinos just throwing this around at a mainstream place.
So for you as a journalist, what is it like for you to just say, wow, I am working at one of these huge companies, but a lot of what they do is a little silly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. What our CEO will say is that he sees us more of like as like the distribution, more like a channel where he'll say in the morning they have the maybe some of the silly light stuff, but at night CBS has 60 Minutes, so he sees it more as like we can provide all of that because as humans we're into all of that stuff, you know what I mean? So I feel like that's kind of where we're coming from with that. I like to think of how we can swarm stories with all different parts of that. So when we did Cinco de Mayo, we talked about, well, what's a funny BuzzFeed way we could do this? And we talked about, you know what? People are going to drink no matter what. We're not their parents. They're going to go out and be crazy. So our one post that we did was like 20 do's and don'ts of Cinco de Mayo. And it was basically like, do go have fun. Don't be racist. Like, don't start painting mustaches on yourself and don't start putting on sombreros. We thought that was a fun post that got 500,000 views. We also did the history of Cinco de Mayo. And somebody did like, okay, it's not actually Mexico's independence. Like, this is what it really is.
So when you say that BuzzFeed is leading with the hiring of journalists who are not white, mm-hmm. what does that look like?
One thing that we really are proud of, and one thing that one time somebody wrote about 538 and about Vox and about, are they all just white men? Are they just only hiring white men? And they tried to lump BuzzFeed in there, and we weren't happy about that because there's actually a lot of women leadership at BuzzFeed. There's a lot of people of color. Our LGBT editor said, as I look to the right, I see our deputy editor-in-chief, Shawnee Hilton, who's a black woman. I see Adrian Carrasquillo, who's here. You know, I see like so many people just near me. We have a lot of great black journalists doing awesome stuff on African-American culture, but just on other stuff too. And you know, our initiative that we're growing with hiring Latino journalists and BuzzFeed, one of the things that I was very familiar with when I came was that we lead on a lot of LGBT coverage as well. And like 65-70% of our editorial is women. Some of the funniest women I've ever met in my life. So they're hilarious. So I feel really good about that side of it.
So you've been able to say what you don't want to do mm-hmm. in terms of BuzzFeed. But are there other places in the world of journalism that you're mm-hmm. looking at and saying, that's stuff we want to do?
Always looking, and I'm always seeing. I've been seeing some great stuff recently from Remezcla, and I always know they were out there. And I've just been seeing more and more stuff. And I actually reached out to one of them on Twitter, and I said, "I like your stuff, and I want to see. Like, do you have a list of your writers on Twitter? Because I want to follow more of it." So, if I see the word Latino somewhere, or if I see a story that I think that is something interesting, then we kind of talk about, well, how can we do it?
Adrian Carrasquillo, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you for having me.
Adrian Carrasquillo is the editor of Latino coverage at BuzzFeed. And speaking of Remezcla, they've just launched a new version of their website. If you've never heard of them, some people describe them as the Latino answer to Vice. They're a music and culture site devoted to young, creative Latinos and Latin Americans. We stopped by their office to check out their work environment and find out where they see themselves within the growing world of Latino media.
Usually, I don't know if people fight to get the chance to play. It's more like, it's your turn and now you gotta do it. Remezcla started kind of as a newsletter, right? Which was, it was just a group of young creatives who didn't really see themselves represented anywhere. First generation, second generation, but people who all felt connected to Latino identity, something that didn't fit squarely within the box of what mainstream media has conceived of as Latino. My name's Andrea Gompf, and I'm a senior editor here.
That's the water cooler.
Talk about a business that started with no money. This is a business that, you know, really was about volunteers and us being, you know, at every concert with a clipboard chasing you down for your email.
My name's Andrew Herrera. I'm the CEO of Remezcla.
I think we help develop scenes that exist and also help create scenes that don't exist.
We could have created probably an easier name that would have been, you know, indielatinmusic.com. But I think what we chose to do is actually create a name that, you know, had meaning whether you understood it or whether you didn't.
Right now we're editing this video on this producer called Milkman. So we're doing color correction, sound design, pretty much getting ready to upload it soon.
Hey, what up, what up, what up? It's your boy Milk. We're out here in Brooklyn with the homies from Remezcla. We're in the studio, just like bumping beats, making music. We're doing it all day, man.
A lot of advertisers don't even know that there's actually an alternative that exists. The population continues to grow, but the proportional amount of advertising dollars that actually go towards Hispanics is still, you know, 10 to 15% of an advertising budget.
Latin urban is just, I think, like how we're redefining being from cities where it's really complex.
Como una mezcla de sabores, como quien dice, de Latinoamérica, mezclado con diferentes culturas, pero con el toque latino.
The most relevant thing you can do to people that are bicultural is to create something that doesn't alienate anybody.
Latin culture is mainstream. Like, you know, it's everywhere and it touches everything.
You're radio shy? You're not radio shy.
And now to California, where the energy industry and agriculture are targeting the same limited resources. The process for extracting oil and natural gas trapped underground is called fracking, and it's taking place now all over the country. In California, Kern County sits at the southern end of the Central Valley. There, farmers facing an historic drought are worried that fracking threatens their precious water supplies. Reporter Mark Hertzgard has our story.
It's recess at Sequoia Elementary School in the farming town of Shafter. On the other side of the playground is an organic community garden where residents Rodrigo Romo and Annabel Marquez are picking vegetables.
Solamente estamos cortando un poco de zucchinis porque ya se están llegando la temporada de quitarlas.
Romo says, we're cutting a little zucchini. They're ripe.
Aprovechando para hacer comida, cocinar.
Para cocinar.
Marquez adds that having this space has been great. But residents were surprised and unhappy when oil wells were drilled barely 100 yards away.
Queremos comer saludable y la contaminación.
We want to eat healthy and the contamination gets closer. How can we teach our children how to eat healthy if there's contamination here?
Saludablemente si está la contaminación aquí.
Standing in this garden, I can see three wells, and each of them has been fracked. Juan Flores works with the Center for Race, Poverty, and the Environment, a national environmental justice organization.
And last year, when we had the grand opening of the garden, we noticed that they were putting those pumps up and that there were some drilling going on. The smells could be so bad that it could actually hurt you. You would feel headaches, you would feel dizzy, nauseous. So last year, that's when we got all into getting to know more about fracking and getting our community members educated.
I head out to the western part of Kern County, where most of California's oil production and fracking takes place.
So we're on Highway 33 in western Kern County here, and there's scrub. It's very dry here. It's desert, and it's called the Petroleum Highway for good reason, because all up and down this strip of highway, pretty much as far as you can see, are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of oil wells. I encounter a similar vista at the Kern oil field on the outskirts of Bakersfield, where I'm joined by Nick Ortiz of the Western States Petroleum Association. Ortiz says oil was discovered here in the 1890s.
California is the third largest oil-producing state in the nation, behind Texas and North Dakota.
Part of that status is due to fracking. Ortiz says hydraulic fracturing is a tool that's been used in California for decades and has a bright future.
We most definitely need petroleum in order to ensure that our economy thrives. And I think Kern County is a great microcosm of that. When you look at our industries here, you know, you have petroleum production, but you also have agriculture. You can't plow a field without diesel. You can't bring product to market without a truck.
Tom France is a fourth-generation Kern County farmer, born and raised on this farm near Shafter.
It's a fairly good day today as far as air quality goes. It's a little hazy, but it's not that ugly grayish-brown haze we have so much of the time as a place with the worst air quality in the nation.
In a study by the American Lung Association, Kern County topped most of the lists of the most polluted counties in the United States. There are lots of culprits, pesticides and trucks connected to farming, but also leakage of benzene and methane from oil production. On this early summer morning, France walks out to the orchards to prune almond trees, which he started growing here in 1983.
Sorry, these are Monterey nuts and these are nonpareil.
Like a lot of farmers, France owns this land, but not the mineral rights beneath it. The people who do can lease those mineral rights to oil companies.
The fracking has started 10 years ago in this agricultural area where we're standing, just a mile or two from here.
Now, he says, wells have been fracked in every direction around him. To France, in places where agriculture thrives, oil and water don't mix.
They're taking it out of the water cycle. When I water my trees, there's trans-evaporation of that water out of these leaves, but that water goes into the air basically as steam and forms clouds somewhere and drops it again on the earth. When they use it for fracking, they've destroyed it forever because they dispose of it then back 5,000 feet under the ground where it just stays forever. So I don't like that one bit.
Fracking a single well can require 2 to 8 million gallons of water. Opponents question the scale of water use, especially in the middle of California's historic drought. France also worries about potential contamination of groundwater. In 2012, he videotaped a subsidiary of Occidental Petroleum illegally dumping black liquid into an open pit a few feet from trees. That act led to a fine of $60,000.
This is an almond in an immature stage. Just bite it open there. Right now, that almond is a jelly. It's 100% water right now. That turns into a solid nut or seed in another month or so. All right. Everything in this almond is dependent on what's in the soil and what's in the water that grows these trees. And so first time something shows up in our almonds, a little chemical, like a little benzene or something, a little trace, no one's going to buy almonds from here anymore. We grow 2 billion pounds of almonds in a year right now. So you know, it's like a $50 billion industry here in the valley. And fracking has a potential to wipe that out, to put a reputation on our product.
I bring up these health and safety concerns to Ortiz of the Petroleum Association. He refers to a bill passed in California last year, Senate Bill 4. SB 4 requires oil companies to register their fracking operations with the state and disclose them to nearby residents. It also requires the state to conduct a study of fracking's implications for health, the economy, and the environment.
Californians, I think, can be assured, regardless of where they are in California, that under the rules that govern us today and all of the pieces of SB 4 that are yet to be implemented, Californians will be well protected by the most comprehensive set of regulations in the nation.
Nevertheless, Ortiz acknowledges that the Western States Petroleum Association did not support passage of the bill. Meanwhile, fracking's future in California suffered a major blow in May when the federal government cut by 96% its estimate of how much recoverable oil exists beneath the Central Valley. Back at the community garden in Shafter, residents like Rosario Garcia believe that fracking is already hurting their community.
The climate is a little bad because they're excavating and putting in tons of chemicals.
Garcia says he's had great difficulties breathing for 2 years after contracting valley fever. It's a disease caused by certain fungi in the soil getting stirred up by things like farming, construction, and oil drilling. Garcia says two of his best friends died from it.
This illness comes from some time ago, and we're seeing more of it because of the fracking.
My name is Miguel Garcia, and I am 9 years old, and I am in third grade.
Garcia's son, Miguel, has been diagnosed with serious asthma.
When I have asthma, my chest hurts, I have headaches. It feels like if my heart was hurting, but it's actually my chest. And then I feel like if I was going to die, I have to not play around with dirt and stay healthy. I feel mad because I can't play outside with my friends.
Oil and farming are both central to California's economy, and both need water. There's an old saying, oil and water don't mix. Now, fracking is testing that truism, and as California endures one of the worst droughts in its history, the stakes could hardly be higher. For Latino USA, I'm Mark Hertzgard.
Coming up on Latino USA.
I always say that we don't sell a brand, that we sell a sentiment. You know, they want something to remind them home.
A trip to a mall in the D.C. suburbs. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Canciones de olvido, después de una noche de haber sucumbido a la anfeta ciudad, debía contestar.
los ojos de mi voz delgada y aliento jarocho que me hacía cantar. No supe contestar. Eras tú.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And now we follow the trail of a group that's targeting Latinos who love nature and might not know it yet. Latino Outdoors is an organization that takes Latino communities outside on anything from camping trips to parrilladas in their local park. Eduardo Gonzalez has a favorite stretch of woods in the Calaveras Big Trees State Park in California, and this time he's bringing his family along. Angela Bass has our story.
¿Te gusta el árbol? ¿No te gusta? ¿No?
Eduardo Gonzalez is guiding a group of Latinos of all ages through a maze of big old trees. He's 23, and he stops us so we can all look up.
So we are standing in the North Grove. So it is one of the northernmost giant sequoia groves in the state. And just, it's absolutely beautiful. It's mixed conifer, so meaning we have everything from pines to firs to just, and the sequoias, of course, as a treat.
Eduardo has walked this trail before, but never as a guide for Latino Outdoors. The statewide project started staging hikes, walks, and camping trips earlier this year. Eduardo was one of the project's 9 leaders and counting.
My mission really with the Latino Outdoors outings is kind of to reconnect that bond that we have with nature and whatnot, because I feel sometimes we forget that. Like, we have this connection with nature and it's lost in just like the daily life, just like work and school. And sometimes you just need to take a step back and go back to nature and whatnot.
For a lot of Latinos, the road back to nature is a short one. 83% of the nation's farm workers are Latino. And recent reports show that most Latino voters care deeply about climate change, environmental pollution, and going camping, picnicking, or fishing with family. This is exactly the kind of stuff Eduardo's own family has been doing since he was a kid.
My parents, since I was a little kid, they'd always take us camping once a year.
That's Eduardo's cousin, Melina Gonzalez. She's on today's hike, too, with 6 of her brothers and sisters. And her parents are just a few steps behind.
When we were kids, we used to go to Yosemite once a year. And I just love it. I love being in nature.
That camping experience at Yosemite with Melina and her family left a mark on Eduardo.
That there was kind of really the hook to really just like the outdoors or whatnot and really loving that environment. So then we did that trip and just it was incredible.
Before that trip to Yosemite, Eduardo spent a week at an outdoor science camp for 6th graders.
That was probably my first time. Actually, in fact, that was my first time in a forest. Like, I had never seen a forest up until that time. I'm really grateful for the freedom that we got out in the outdoors, because like out there, it was like a playground almost.
Eduardo never outgrew that playground. After high school, he put college on hold to volunteer as a camp counselor and student naturalist at Shady Creek Outdoor School in the Sierra Nevada foothills. He did that for a year, training as an outdoor educator, no pay. And after that, he volunteered at his college's natural history museum. Eduardo says his construction worker father wasn't happy about any of it. He'd say things like,
"Oh, why do you do that? Or are they paying you to do that? Like, oh, like you could be doing something else, or just kind of like, ¿para qué pierdes tu tiempo? Like, why are you wasting your time?" He's like, "Don't you think that's a little much? Like going all the way out there, like just like that."
Eduardo says his father is slowly accepting the fact that naturalist educators don't always rake in the big bucks. So we keep walking and stop in front of this massive tree. It looks like it's poking the sky, but Eduardo says it's not just the tree's height that makes it so spellbinding.
So this tree has a sad history in the sense that they call it the mother of the forest. So due to its magnificence, they thought it would be great to take the bark off of it and piece it back together as a traveling show to prove the grandness of these giant sequoias we have here in California.
Eduardo hopes nature's magnificence can get kids off the couch, including his 11-year-old cousin, Irving Gonzalez.
The person that's doing this, my cousin, he took me here for camping, me and my little brother, and we came here for a hike and just to come out of the house.
What do you normally do on Saturdays?
Play video games.
Half of the hikers here today are related to Eduardo. Even his dad would have come if he didn't have to work. His mom, Maria Gonzalez, is here. She grew up working on her father's dairy farm in Jalisco, Mexico.
La naturaleza de aquí no se parece a la de México tampoco. Es muy diferente, pero está bien aquí.
She said that nature is very different from Mexico to here.
Eduardo spent his childhood summers on that farm in Jalisco. He remembers waking up before daybreak with the men in his family to help mix cow feed.
But I just enjoyed like that feeling of just being out there with my grandfather and just kind of watching him milk his cows and whatnot.
Nowadays, Eduardo works a paid gig as a hydrologic technician on the Plumas National Forest in the Sierra Nevada for the U.S. Forest Service. And he dreams of one day hiking all the way to Canada from Mexico.
Turn around. Let's just take a picture. Where is that then? Get in the picture, Eduardo. Come on, buddy. Oh, should we take a regular one?
For Latino USA, I'm Angela Bass in California's Central Valley.
Latino Outdoors has been around for less than 2 years, but they've already taken more than 200 Latinos on outings just like the one we heard. Those numbers matter because statistics from the National Park Service show that Latinos are woefully underrepresented in visits to the national parks. So we invited Latino Outdoors to talk about what's keeping Latinos inside. Joining me now from the Radio Bilingüe studios in Oakland, California, is Jose Gonzalez, who's the director and founder of Latino Outdoors. Jose, welcome to Latino USA.
Hola a todos, María. Es un placer estar aquí.
It's funny Great because you and I actually know each other mostly through our shared Instagram posts, right?
Correct, yes.
I mean, you're always posting about being outdoors, about them some doing some hike. So why is connecting to nature so important to you as a Latino?
No, pues claro, it's so important to me because my own personal experience and background, and I grew up in the outdoors, but I was born in Mexico. So I carried that connection to the outdoors when my family migrated to the U.S. This is where I first connected to like state and national parks. And I thought, you know, we belong here. And if these are public spaces, how are we connecting with these spaces?
Did you find that there were barriers for Latinos staying away from the outdoors?
You know, we do have some barriers that research has identified, like, you know, transportation, for example, knowledge or awareness of what's available. Language may be a barrier in some cases. So when we bring that to like Latino professionals who also are conservation professionals, we use our Latino identity and our outdoor identity to help make these connections with communities.
Now, there is an issue. Undocumented Latinos have a real reaction to the uniforms that the National Parks officers wear.
Definitely. I had a friend colleague who's a ranger tell me, he's like, Jose, I'm just going to be honest with you. He's like, I have white communities who love me. Like, they see me. I am that happy, jolly ranger. I'm helpful. But I go into some of my Latino communities that I'm trying to like get some awareness for them about what I do in the parks. And the first reaction is like, you're law enforcement, or, you know, why are you asking questions? You look a little too friendly for us, and we're not, you know, how do we know you're not working for immigration? Just because they see the color and the badge. You know, we need to be able to change the color and just the habits and the practices that shows communities that the National Park Service is welcoming. We know it's trying to. We know the intent is there. We just got to make sure that the work keeps happening.
So your organization, Latino Outdoors, what do you do, in fact, to get Latinos outdoors? And what parts of the country are you working on?
Well, we're national now, which is fantastic. We grew out of California. We're getting volunteer staff and coordinators, ambassadors from California, Texas, Wyoming, Massachusetts, starting up in New York. And then we can use that community as a resource to connect our youth, not just outdoors, but to this identity and to value it, to get a mentor, to see this as a career pathway. And then we use this network and our volunteer staff to then actually get families outdoors, because we want the parents to value this and see this connected. There's something magical about seeing a 3-year-old playing with the leaves and a 60-year-old grandparent also like enjoying the space together.
Jose Gonzalez, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA. And I'll see you on Instagram, I guess, the next time you're
claro
taking a hike.
Sí. Claro que sí. Thank you, María.
Jose Gonzalez is the founder and director of Latino Outdoors. And now to the suburbs of Washington, D.C. in Maryland, where there's a special mall called La Union. It's full of Central American-owned businesses. It caters to the area's booming Latino population. People come from nearby states to get all kinds of products that they want. But now, merchants at La Union are worried that the mall's days might be numbered. That's because the D.C. Metro is adding a new route called the Purple Line that's intended to connect far-flung suburbs to Washington, D.C.'s downtown. But merchants at the mall are afraid that they might be pushed out if their rents continue to rise.
Well, Mall La Union is like a little town, you know, el pueblito, also called el Mall del Pueblo. My name is Jorge Sactic. I'm from Guatemala.
El mollete tiene manjar de leche así como este adentro, lo blanco. Tiene esto adentro.
I like the bakery because I see like dozens of people here every day, and I like to chat with every one of them as that I can.
Tortuguita, pan de yema, concha.
I always say that we don't sell bread, that we sell sentiment. You know, they want something to remind them home.
Mi nombre es Edmundo, y soy de Guatemala. Vivo solo en este país.
My name is Edmundo, and I'm from Guatemala. I live alone in this country, so, you know, when you're all alone here, you start to get bored in your house. And that's the reason why I came to this mall, so I could enjoy myself with my friends here.
My name is Zoila. We're here at Olga's parties. For quinceañeras, we sell a lot of dresses, tiaras, photo albums, children's party favors, and even balloons. We have everything here.
$10 sería francés o pirujo. Hola, molletío, su señora.
My name is Patricio Zamora, and I've been working here at La Union Mall for about 10 years. I have a photography studio and also another business, a limousine service. I understand that they're starting to build the Purple Line in a year and a half or 2 years. We're a little worried about how the train is going to affect us during construction. They've already raised rents in the mall. Personally, they raised my rent around 80%. It's an abuse, an injustice.
Un abuso. This is the third decade that we're here. And when we came here, nobody wants to put a foot in here. Now we move in, we revive the area, we've been like supporting local governments through our taxes, we have created jobs, we support this community of workers who serve the whole Washington metropolitan area. We are not against the projects. You know, the Purple Line is going to be fantastic, you know. It's great. But how good it's going to be if we won't be here.
Anne Hoffman produced that piece for us. Earlier in this show, we brought up Latinos as a target market. A new poll out this week took a deeper look at Latino families. The poll was carried out by Latino Decisions and was commissioned by the Kellogg Foundation. Full disclosure, the Kellogg Foundation provides support for Latino USA. But to talk about why these poll findings are important, we wanted to go straight to the source. So this week, we invited Barbara Ferrer, the Chief Strategy Officer for the Kellogg Foundation, to give us some words of wisdom, some sabiduría, about who we are as Latinos.
Within the findings of this poll, it actually made it crystal clear how diverse the Latino community is in the United States. You know, diverse in terms of country of origin, diverse in terms of length of time in the United States. Many of the people who participated in our poll were earning less than 40,000 dollars a year for their family's income. On the other hand, we had a significant number of people, over 50%, who were earning more than $40,000 a year. You know, for a few years in Boston, I worked as a high school headmaster. And in my school, I had a high percentage of Latino students. For my Central American students, immigration status was having a profound effect on their ability to find opportunities in the United States. All of my parents were very engaged in their own child's academic performance, regardless of whether they came from El Salvador or Mexico or Puerto Rico or U.S.-born Dominicans. The common thread was high level of engagement, which again we saw in this survey in terms of parents participating in the lives of their child as it pertained to their schooling. On the other hand, parents were very quick to point out that if you wanted high rates involvement, for example, on school governance issues, you needed to pay a lot more attention to some of the structural barriers. So if you're going to create parent council meetings that are happening in the middle of the day, you're going to make it impossible for lots of parents who have work to be able to participate. Easy example, you're running a school and you know that, you know, there are four primary languages that are spoken by students and their families in your school besides English. Shouldn't your signage reflect that so that when parents and family members and community members walk in the door, the welcome sign says welcome in multiple languages so that they know that you genuinely want them in your community and that you are making every effort to be inclusive in offering them opportunities to participate.
Some words of wisdom about understanding Latinos from Barbara Ferrer. Well, my dear listeners, that's it for this week. But if you're interested in learning more about multicultural marketing and the new Mad Men, tune in to our PBS series, America by the Numbers with Maria Hinojosa. We're also online on the World Channel and at americabythenumbers.org. Please watch and let us know what you think. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Laura Calzada and Julia Hsu. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks this week to Robert Fraser and Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And we'll see you on your local PBS station on America by the Numbers. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Funding for our series Radio Nature is provided by the REI Foundation, supporting today's youth to develop a lifetime commitment to nature and the outdoors. Latino USA's tech coverage is supported by the Caper Center for Social Impact, which leverages technology for positive, progressive change. Tech for good, good for tech. CaperCenter.org. And the California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians.
Today, churros.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Inada, maker of DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And Patricia Papper, supporting Perez Art Museum Miami, providing progressive art programming to Miami-Dade County residents and visitors. This is NPR.